Welcome. I'm Yetta Solomon. Before I introduce Dr. Hoffman, I'd like to remind everyone to please either turn your cell phones off or turn them down to vibrate if you have not already done so. Okay. The sign-in sheets for psychologists and social workers for CEU credits are right here. I've handed out evaluations. If you're planning on being here for the second part of the presentation, I'll collect them after the second part. If for any reason you're not, I will collect them at the end of the first part. That's it. Okay. It's my pleasure to introduce Dr. Hoffman. Perry Hoffman is the president and co-founder of the National Education Alliance for Borderline Personality Disorder. She holds several grants from the National Institute of Mental Health with a focus on families who have a relative with borderline personality disorder. She is co-designer of the 12-week psychoeducation course for families, which is called Family Connections, available in many locations, both in the United States as well as in other countries. She is co-editor with John Gunderson of the book Understanding and Treating Borderline Personality Disorder, A Guide for Professionals and Family Members, and co-editor of Borderline Personality Disorder, Meeting the Challenges to Successful Treatment. Dr. Hoffman is trained in dialectical behavior therapy, commonly known as DBT, has been the director of several DBT treatment programs in the New York area, and now is in private practice in New York City and Westchester County. The National Alliance on Mental Illness has recently recognized the efforts of NEA-BBT by awarding Dr. Hoffman its 2011 Excellence in Community Health Award.
Thank you, and thank you for coming. It's a pleasure to be here. And I sort of start my talk out with a thank you. And the thank you is because it's nice to see people interested in this disorder. It's not a disorder that's very popular for mental health professionals. So the fact that you're here is validation that there's some people that really are interested in working with people with this disorder.
When I was 9, I would have like these huge temper tantrums, and it became really hard for me to do anything, feeling like there's something wrong with me and that I'm innately flawed was part of what I think made it so hard. I mean, I was 9 and I was contemplating suicide.
She was so sad and so hollow, and I don't know that you would even be able to fathom that seeing her now. There was nothing there. There was... She just basically given up.
I start out with this clip because I want to orient you to what it's like to have a relative with this disorder. And I've probably seen this clip about 50 times, and that's the last. We don't need the lights off. That was the clip. Thank you, though, and I'm sorry I should have asked for it before. Can someone turn the lights back on? Oh, thanks. This clip is taken from a video series that I have the good fortune to be the co-principal investigator on. We did 90 hours of videotaping 4 families, tracking them over several days on what it's like living as a borderline personality disorder patient and also as a family member. So what I am going to hopefully do today with all of you, once we get the lights on, is I'm going to first walk you through the disorder. I think it's very important that people understand what the disorder is about because the disorder has a lot of negativity surrounding it. And we also know, and perhaps over the last 10 years can say, that this is actually the good prognosis diagnosis. So that being said, let me walk you through the diagnosis so you get a better sense of what it's about. We'll also be talking about families as well and how to better help families. So there is hope for hope. This is taken a translation from a Yiddish article. I must have gotten about 20 phone calls in 1 week, probably about 4 years ago, and then lo and behold found out that there was an article in a Yiddish magazine that was talking about borderline personality disorder, and the phone calls all were from desperate family members. We've read this article that's hopeless. There's nothing out there. We don't know what to do. And I'm just going to show you some lines from that so you can understand sort of what's out in the community. And I'm showing you this one in particular, and then we'll show you what's out in the secular world, and it very much matches. So the person with borderline personality disorder lives in a world of emotion which are extremely exaggerated, very true. There's black and white image of the world, including themselves, often true. No self-confidence, fears of abandonment, no emotional memory, thirst for attention, even negative attention, that I'd have to challenge, and allergic to tranquility, thinks about his own problems, that I would have to challenge too. Not to say that some people with the disorder don't have that, but not everybody does. What this brings is anger, drastic moods, degrading everybody, I'd have to challenge that, and not taking responsibility for actions. One thing you will learn from my presentation today is that this is a very complicated, challenging disorder, and there's not just one face to it. There are 256 different ways somebody can meet criteria for the disorder, which makes every face a different face. The article then went on to say, BPD is total bluff, needs a partner to be his victim. Some of you sitting in the audience who are family members or professionals might say, yep, that fits my relative. But it doesn't necessarily mean it fits other relatives, nor does it necessarily mean that the patient sets out to do this, okay? One of the things that I hope you'll also take away from this talk is that nobody chooses to be borderline, okay? It's not something you sign up for. So what I'm going to be doing today is talking about the background of the disorder, the prevalence and nature of the disorder, to tell or not to tell, do we share the diagnosis with people, what's the etiology, the course and treatment, and what to do to help families. I don't have handouts. Yeah. Now, what I'm going to do is I'm going to put them up on the website. I'm president of an organization called the National Education Alliance for Borderline Personality Disorder, and we're a not-for-profit organization, all volunteer. We've just hit our 10th anniversary, and we have a website, very easy to remember, borderlinepersonalitydisorder.com. I was lucky enough to buy that about 12 years ago. And so on that site, what I will do is do a specific thing for the NEFISH conference, okay? The logon will be NEFISH, and the password will be NEFISH 2011. So all this will be up there. Okay, so let's first be open and honest. How many people here work with BPD patients? Okay, good. How many like working with them? Okay. Not every hand, but that's okay. And how many people refer BPD patients out? Oh, that's less than I would have thought, so that's good. Oftentimes, what unfortunately people are hearing in social work school is the best thing to do is to refer a BPD patient out. So it's very sad of what's going on. And why? How do we account for that? Well, perhaps this explains a lot. There was an article written in 1988... and it defined what's most stressful for mental health professionals. Did not mean borderline or borderline professionals, but what the three things are suicide attempts, threats of suicide, and patient anger. Those are the three things that are most difficult when you're working with someone with BPD. So when we know that's what's most stressful, of course this disorder is incredibly distressful. And then there's Time Magazine, it's just about 2 years ago next month, that had an article on dialectical behavior therapy, actually. And if you see the circle at the top, what that says is that borderline personality, the disorder doctors fear the most. It's a nice thing to know about when you're a relative or a patient, that this is what's being, it's out in the community. Then there's Ken Duckworth, who's the medical director of NAMI, who said, if you hated the patient, The patient was pissing you off. You would bandy this term about, oh, you're just borderline. It was a diagnosis of wastebasket hostility. So let's look at some myth or fact. BPD patients try to defeat therapists. Well, I see some head shaking. They don't purposely mean to do that. This is part of the disorder. Patients with BPD do not improve. They absolutely do improve. We call it the good prognosis diagnosis. An unlikable person must have BPD. And that's often what people are said. It's diagnostic if you don't like your patient. They must have borderline. BPD is a death sentence. Not true. Don't say the BPD diagnosis. Comorbid disorders can be treated effectively without treating BPD. That is probably the most horrific thing, because if we don't know that we're treating borderline personality disorder, other things are not going to remit, and I'll show you a little more on that. The diagnosis cannot be made before age 18. Also not true and shouldn't be true, and people need to think about the diagnosis at a younger age, because early intervention for everything is the key to recovery. Here are facts now. Is the BPD is environmentally induced. If someone were to live on an island, they wouldn't look borderline. Some people look borderline only in some relationships, not in other relationships. Patients do not choose to have BPD. Recovery is possible and likely. And after 2 years, more than 50% of patients recover. After 10 years, more than 80% recover. And 88% remain in recovery. Yeah. This is a study I'll show you in a few minutes. It was done up at McLean Hospital. They weren't all in treatment, but they had entered a treatment system. That's how they got into the study. 40% of BPD patients previously diagnosed bipolar have borderline. Now, 25% of patients also have bipolar, so we have to be careful on that. But there are 40% of people who think they have bipolar disorder that really have borderline personality disorder. Borderline is an underdiagnosed, misunderstood, and overstigmatized disorder. The diagnosis of BPD is often withheld from patients and families. And again, BPD is a good prognosis diagnosis. So those are facts. It's important to note that borderline personality disorder is a disorder of relationships. I'm going to run through the criteria very quickly, just underlining the key words. And 7 of the 9 criteria impact relationships. Somebody can get into a new relationship that doesn't pull for the same things that other relationships do, and they don't look borderline, they don't act borderline. But in other relationships, they can. I had a psychiatrist that I worked with many years ago and still work with on some level, who said that that what's more therapeutic than therapy is a healthy relationship for someone with borderline personality disorder. So here are some of the criteria. Just running down them, I'm just going to do the underlined words. Think about how this impacts relationships, families in particular. Abandonment, unstable and intense interpersonal relationships, identity disturbance, impulsivity, recurrent suicidal behavior, affective instability, that's up and down, feelings of emptiness, intense anger or difficulty controlling anger, paranoid ideation or transient severe dissociative symptoms. So 7 of those 9 symptoms. Or if we organize them in terms of dysregulations, this is how they look. Interpersonal dysregulation, affective emotion dysregulation, behavioral dysregulation, self-dysregulation. Those are the 4 constellations of dysregulation. I want to just quickly run through the history of borderline personality disorder, because I think it's had a unique trajectory in how it evolved and where it's coming to now, and thank goodness where it's coming to now. So in the 1970s, it was thought to be a variant of schizophrenia. In the 1980s, a variant of depression. In the 1990s, a variant of PTSD. And then in the 2000s, a variant of bipolar disorder. And I see clinicians nodding their heads, because if you know the disorder, you can track back how it got to this point. And here are some pejorative attributions to borderline patients. They're frequent flyers, which means that they're in and out of hospitals, that they're help-rejecting complainers, that they're intractable, they're treatment-resistant, they're irresponsible, fickle, egocentric, and they're emotional hypochondriacs, meaning that they're attention-seeking. I'm not saying that some of these don't fit some of these behaviors that we see, but we have to also be careful about what we think is driving those behaviors. And that's where some of the skills that we teach families are more about what we call benign interpretation. When somebody is doing self-injury, it's not necessarily because they want attention, but it's a way of managing their emotions. And I'll go a little more into that. So if we go back to the history, we're now sort of in our current day. And who do we have who's appeared on the scene about 15 to 20 years ago? It's Dr. Marsha Linehan. She is the creator of dialectical behavior therapy, which really revolutionized the disorder. It not only gave a treatment to clinicians, but it also told hospitals, don't admit borderline personality disorder patients. Before, they used to be flooding the emergency rooms, and now more and more, as Marsha did, she oriented the emergency rooms in Seattle, and she said, if a patient of mine comes in, don't admit them. Call me. Hospitalizations are not what are helpful. And this is what Marsha Linehan says about BPD patients. Borderline individuals are the psychological equivalent of third-degree burn victims. They simply have, so to speak, no emotional skin. Even the slightest touch or movement can create immense suffering for them. And if you think of that, if you think of these as burn victims with no skin, it does allow you to enter a different world than they're manipulative, they're out to get you, they don't think of anybody else. These are people with a severe psychiatric disorder, but one that can get better. And Marsha says, assuming the worst is destructive. I don't know how many of you know that she came out in June to declare that she has borderline personality disorder, or had it. It was a very moving conference. It was by invitation only. There were 200 people at the Institute of Living in Hartford, where she had spent 2.5 years. So she chose to make her announcement there. It was really kind of touching. She went first on one of the inpatient units and shared it with the patients. And she said, I was here. I sat in the same chairs that you're sitting in now, and I want you to know that you can get better. And what she also said at her presentation that day was that she vowed that she was going to get out of hell, and she was going to come back and get other people out of hell as well. So those of you who want to read more about it, if you go on our website, it's on the front page, and you can click and read the New York Times article. Part of why she did this and came out was because she wanted to be an inspiration to people, but also because her sister wanted to volunteer and work with people who have a relative with a psychiatric disorder. And she said, Marsha, I can't do this because I can't out you unless you first let people know. So we're very, very pleased to say that not only has her sister come to help families, but she's been trained to do our Family Connections group. And actually, it was very moving because the day the New York Times article came out was the day that she did her first group. And I was fortunate enough to just come in and sit for a few minutes to hear her, Marsha's sister's name is Aileen, for her to share her story, what it was like to have a sibling with this disorder. So we're very pleased about that. So here we are in the present. And borderline personality disorder is to psychiatry what psychiatry is to medicine, okay? Those of you who are doctors will know that people are told, why would you want to be a psychiatrist? And psychiatrists are said, why do you want to treat borderline personality disorder patients? So, and if we look now at what's being done in terms of research, keep this in mind when we do the prevalence rates, okay? Because if you look at schizophrenia, there's $300 million being spent on schizophrenia, and it affects 0.4 of the population. If you jump down to BPD, there's 6 million, and it affects over 5 0.9% of the population. This to me speaks about where the disorder is. It's underrepresented in research, it's underrepresented in clinics, it's just totally unrepresented, misrepresented, and overstigmatized. But the good news is that Congress passed in 2008 a House resolution declaring May as Borderline Personality Disorder Month. And I won't read that to you. You can see it when you go on the website. So let's, for a few minutes, talk about the prevalence and the nature of the disorder. What do we need to know? Well, we need to know, again, that it's about 5.9% of the general population. That doesn't mean that's who goes for treatment. Okay, this was a study that was done out in the community across the nation. It makes up for about 11% in mental health clinics. 19% of people who are in inpatient psychiatric hospitals have BPD. And in primary care, which I think is very important, 6% have the disorder. It's a high-risk population. 10% of people with BPD die by suicide. With all suicides, these are not just BPD people, 9 to 33% are by individuals with BPD. So this is really a public health problem. Up to 75% of individuals with BPD have cut, burned, hit, or otherwise injured themselves. Again, 8 to 10% lifetime suicide rate. The mean age of people with the disorder who do make attempts are age 30. Who successfully complete attempts. 60 to 70% of non-suicidal is self-injury. There are limitations in predicting suicide in all diagnostic categories, including BPD, and most patients with BPD do not kill themselves early in the course of the illness. 70% of persons with BPD make at least one suicide attempt and 10 complete them. Self-injury is up to about 75%, and self-injury can look very different. It can be cutting, burning, headbanging. I have one patient who takes a tweezer and sort of picks a little bit. So there's a broad continuum on what self-injury can look like. But self-injury is not suicidal, but it's a means of relieving psychic pain. And many patients report they don't feel the physical pain at the moment when they cut themselves. But instead, the cutting engenders feelings of relief or well-being. It often serves as a form of self-medication. When I see the heads nodding, I'm assuming these are clinicians who are saying, yep, this makes sense, or that you already know it. So let's look for a minute at the functions of the self-injury in BPD. For 59%, it's to feel concrete pain. For 49%, it's to inflict self-punishment. 39%, it reduces anxiety disorder, and anxiety is a big, big comorbid disorder with BPD. For 22%, it's to feel in control. 22%, it's a way of expressing anger. 20%, to feel something when instead you feel numb. 17%, to seek help from others. And for 15%, to keep bad memories away. When we look at the impairments, yeah. It doesn't mean it. Some people with schizophrenia will self-injure when they're psychotic, but I would venture to say if you're seeing someone self-injuring, you want to look for borderline personality disorder. It's one of the hallmarks of the disorder, but 100% it doesn't make someone BPD. Yes. Impairments in functioning are high internal levels of anxiety and distress, high family distress and stress, difficulty keeping jobs, over-emotional and impulsive, self-injurious behavior, as we've said, and stormy interpersonal relationships. This doesn't have to be across the board, though. Someone with BPD does not have to have those stormy relationships in every relationship that we know. Actually, what I'm finding more is that I will get a spouse who'll come to me, it's often a man, who'll say, my wife has borderline personality disorder. And I listen, and boy, it sure sounds that way. And then either by coercion or by the person looking for some help from her own emotional pain, the wife will come in. And what I'll find is that she doesn't have borderline personality disorder. There's something in the dynamic in the relationship that's pulling for this more maybe high emotional intensity, and it could be a variety of things. One is that the husband doesn't express emotions, and so the wife, in an effort to get him to express something, she'll look more dysregulated than she'd look anywhere else. That the borderline, you're saying the person with the disorder, very little, very little. Do you see it more? Yeah. Okay. Yeah. I'm saying that it's probably out there. I would also look for what else is driving it. One of the concerns I have for the disorder is that people will say, oh, that's borderline, because they do this, this, and this. It might in part be some symptoms of BPD, but there might be something else going on as well. So we want to look at the more narrow picture and the larger picture. John Gunderson, who is really the father of this disorder, I'm sure all of you know that DSM-5 is under transition, and there are heated arguments on borderline. One week it was that the disorder needed to be merged with another disorder, which would have really been a shame, because if that had happened, we would have lost any ability to do research, because it would have been lost in a larger picture. First of all, there's not going to be personality disorders per se, so it'll be a continuum. But at least on the continuum, there'll be part of it will be recognized as borderline personality disorder. I think they were going to put it under some mood disorder, and forget access 2. It's not going to be there. Everything's going to be, they're not going to divide it up into access 1 and access 2. That was this week. Maybe by the time you get the handouts, it'll be something else. But there have been a lot of discussions with the BPD clinicians and researchers, and particularly Dr. John Gunderson leading sort of the effort that things don't get lost with the disorder. And what Dr. Gunderson in particular doesn't want to get lost with the disorder is the focus on interpersonal dysfunction, that if we lose that, and I think that's true, because that's in large part where you do see the disorder getting played out. So he's been very a strong advocate to get it for them not to lose that. The interpersonal dysfunction of BPD offers the best discrimination for the diagnosis, and the mood shifts and self-destructive behaviors in BPD often occur in response to interpersonal triggers. And I love this last thing too. That's versus in bipolar disorder, where mood shifts occur from stress and sleep-related triggers. So borderline, when you see an episode or someone really getting more dysregulated, look for what happened interpersonally, less with the bipolar, where the relationship might suffer from their mania, because it's hard to be with someone who's manic, but it's not directed at the person. In taking a history, look to see if the symptoms are triggered by interpersonal stress. Is the depression treatment resistant, and this is so crucial, this is where the comorbidity comes in. I'll talk about that in a minute. Does the patient self-harm? So you do see that as a hallmark. And are the relationships unstable? What makes this disorder even more challenging is that almost 85% of patients with BPD met criteria for Access 1, and they have more than just one Access 1 disorder. Most common are mood disorders, anxiety disorders, substance abuse disorders. I'd also slip in there a little eating disorders, because I think it's there's some of these comorbid disorders that really trip up the BPD piece, and the BPD trips up that piece. So I think eating disorders needs to be recognized. And here's a whole list of comorbid disorders. Yes. Oh, no, it's definitely a true comorbidity. I mean, I've been working with BPD patients now for maybe 25 years, and I've never seen a patient that doesn't have another disorder. I mean, it just rarely stands alone. And this is the next slide. That's what it says on the bottom. And if you look at it, you can see BPD is in the middle and all of these different disorders that cluster around it. I mean, it's interesting because the name borderline personality disorder came up when it was thought that people were between being neurotic and psychotic, and that people have backed away from that. There's also been an urge to change the name. But as Dr. Tom Insel, who's the director of NIMH, says, you're not going to change anything by changing the name, and we all have a common language with it. But that being said, one reason to keep the name is that it borders on all these disorders. And how does the comorbidity impact recovery? Very important that the persistence of major depression and BPD, that if you don't treat the major depression, if you don't treat the borderline piece in someone who has major depression, the depression is not going to lift. 57% of cases would not have persisted in the follow-up period in the absence of BPD. And what's quite unfortunate is I think that BPD clinicians and researchers are very attuned to the comorbidity. I don't think that other experts in other disorders are. I attended a conference on bipolar disorder and asked a question about borderline personality disorder, and they said, oh, we don't really consider that disorder in the work that we do with people. And that's very unfortunate because then the treatment's not going to be given what needs to be given. And here's just some more things about the persistence of major depression and bipolar disorder. Also, alcohol and substance abuse in borderline personality disorder, also crucial to note. And 50% of BPD patients have either alcohol or substance abuse disorders. Exactly. It's another form of self-medication. The prevalence decreases over time as somebody gets older. And the family history showed a strong aggregation with impulse spectrum disorder. And I'm going to go a little bit about the heritability of this. Active substance abuse, I think this is important, can show false positives for BPD. So some people who do or who are substance abusers might look borderline, but if you take away the substance abuse, then they might not look that way. A co-occurring substance abuse disorders slow time to remission of BPD than any other access disorder. And sobriety of 3 to 6 months should be a prerequisite for BPD treatment. It's hard to treat, for example, DBT skills to someone who's not sober. Psychopharmacology, just going to do very quickly on this. This is from Dr. Joel Paris, and I have to thank all the wonderful presenters who've been at our conferences. We've hosted over 40 conferences across the country, and we get the top researchers. They bring the top presentations, and they give me their top slides. So what you're seeing here really is a compilation of all these wonderful researchers who have devoted their careers to BPD, and some of their slides have been included in here. We can prescribe antipsychotics, but patients with BPD do not have true psychosis. This is from Dr. Joel Paris. We can prescribe antidepressants, but patients with BPD do not have classic depression. And we can prescribe mood stabilizers, but the effective instability of BPD is not the same as the symptoms of bipolar disorder. So in terms of psychopharmacology, it's often the adjunctive form of treatment. The most important treatment is psychotherapy. And what it addresses is the effect of instability, the impulsivity, and psychotic-like symptoms. So when we look at what engine is fueling the disorder, any disorder, we ask that people consider the BPD as the primary disorder, because if that's not going to be addressed, it's going to be tripped up. So here's the question. Yeah. Well, ADHD, we're finding out now, is a precursor for when we look at, and you'll see a slide on this, when we look at children who have ADHD, it doesn't mean they'll be borderline, but when we look at adults looking back in their childhood, they have ADHD. And it doesn't mean that I think the disorders have some similarities, but I think it's also could interplay with how the environment interacts with children, with a particular child with ADHD. So I think, yes, you have to also address the ADHD. Well, I'm not a psychiatrist, so I wouldn't say, but I know most psychiatrists will give medication.
Do you sometimes
you know what? I don't ever recommend medication, but I will recommend they go for a psychiatric consultation. So it's just not that's not something I would recommend. No, I mean, it certainly could help. So that's why I would send them for an evaluation. So when a lot of patients are not told the diagnosis of BPD, okay? And why is it often withheld? Because the symptoms can be frightening and frustrating for clinicians. The clinician doesn't want to see it. Clinicians in here agree with that? Yeah, okay. The clinicians can misuse the diagnosis as a pejorative term for the individual. And other diagnoses where there are symptoms of suicidality or anger are less stigmatizing. This, again, is the most stigmatizing disorder of any psychiatric disorders. Yeah. Oh, well, see, yeah.
It's also a stigma, and sometimes it's much better to say, well, you're just having emotional turbulence and you have time to adjust. Give them more hope.
Well, but see, that's what I'm going to challenge, because I think, and I often find this, that's what I say. That's exactly what I say. When they come in and they say, I think I have bipolar disorder or maybe borderline personality disorder, I'll say, I hope you have borderline. It's not a lifelong sentence. People get out of the mental health system with the disorder. There's also a wonderful 16-page pamphlet. It's on that website. It's called a BPD brief. Download it. Let your clients, your patients read it. It shows that this is a disorder that's treatable. So we're shifting away from, oh, poor you, you have borderline. Yes. It's more unpopular. I agree with you. You're right. 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 No, you're absolutely right. You're absolutely right. You win. What? Oh, he said antisocial personality disorder is more unpopular. Yeah. Disorder has been spun over the last 30 years is that everybody has run from it. People have been told they can't get better. Families have been accused of being abusive, both emotionally and sexually, okay? The insinuation, a lot of BPD patients have been abused. A lot of them haven't, okay? A lot of them you go into, you know, you meet their family members, wonderful families, okay? So it's not that the families have done anything so terrible, but unfortunately the literature had spun it that way. And John Gunderson himself, who was writing about this in the 80s, said that he himself vilified parents and that he realizes that parents are not at fault. Might have they done some things not perfectly? I'm a parent. I don't have a child with a mental illness, but boy, I can tell you at times I was invalidating. And when we get to that, I'll give you some invalidating comments, and I bet everybody can say, oh, I said that too. There was a hand raised. We'll get there. Okay. So reasons to disclose. It's important that people be told from a professional, not read it in a chart, okay? And nowadays on the internet, well, forget it, you'll learn that, right? And also that when they're in treatment, sometimes they come for DBT and they're not told they have borderline. Now, that also being said, that DBT is being used for a lot more than a borderline personality disorder, but you want them to know from somebody face-to-face. And oftentimes people will say, why didn't you tell me? It's more respectful to tell the patient, and I won't run through all of these. And when you make the diagnosis, they can get the right treatment. Without the right diagnosis, they can't. All right, so a little bit on etiology. And first of all, 20% of clinical samples, we said, up to 5.9% of the general population. 75% of BPD people who present are female. That doesn't mean that's across the board in the general population. It's really 50-50. It's that females tend to go more for treatment, and also that males often end up in jail instead of the mental health system. So that balances out the percentage.
How does the disorder develop? Well, they're genetic factors, okay, and that they're environmental factors. I'll get to the genetic factors specifically, but what we know is that there are three biological characteristics. The people with its disorder have a high emotional sensitivity, okay? And what that means is that they're quick to react, they're highly sensitive to emotional stimuli, that they notice emotional things that other people don't, that big emotional events hurt more, it takes few stimuli to feel emotions than other people. And I almost see it like if you have a wound on your hand that's healing, you put your hand in the oven to pull out the turkey, that wound feels the heat first. And that's what it's like to be borderline. That person feels things more quickly than somebody else. Not only do they feel it more quickly, but they feel it more intensely. Okay, remember the burn too. It absorbs the heat more than the rest of the hand does. So it's more extreme and more intense reactions. Thinking and problem solving gets thrown off. And the higher magnitude of response to emotional stimuli than what others experience. So it was like if there was a loud noise that came into this room, and think of that sort of as an emotional stimulation as opposed to a physical one, the person with BPD would react more quickly. They would react more intensely, so maybe some of us would go like this, they'd jump higher. And then the third thing, which is very important because it keeps the cycle going, is that it's slower return to baseline, you know? So it takes them a longer time to get back to, okay, I'm more centered, I'm more balanced. So their reactions are more long-lasting. It's a longer time to recuperate. And what that means is because they're still up here and there's another emotional stimuli that hits them, they're likely to react more quickly again. It's like having a fender bender in the car. That ride home, you're like this, right? You're just not cruising along because of what's happened. That's what it feels like for people with BPD. So now on to the genetics of it. What this says is it doesn't mean that people with a mother, let's say, with borderline personality disorder will mean that they will develop the disorder, but it does mean that there's a heritability between 50 to 60%, okay? And what this is consistent with other personality disorders. And the main view is that the traits clusters, so it's traits that are inherited. Impulsivity and mood lability specifically are traits that are passed on genetically. Doesn't mean everybody, but it means 50 to 60%. And so when you look at impulsivity and mood lability, that's borderline personality disorder in part. So those are the genetic components. Just in terms of heritability in general, you can see where BPD falls, schizophrenia being the highest and PTSD the lowest. So we have this genetic component. What we're talking about here is a biosocial theory. There's biology, and then there's something that happens in the environment. And what we believe is that for whatever reason, the environment was not able to meet the needs of that person, okay, that child. A poor fit between the child and the parents or the environment. Also, I want to make it very clear to state that there are a lot of environments children grow up in, right? So it's not just necessarily the home environment Marshall Linehan calls this the invalidating environment. I find that term a little pejorative. I prefer an incompatible environment, but when I discussed it with her, she really sees it as invalidating, so I'm not going to fight with Marshall Linehan. So when we see that something happens in the environment, it can be at home, it can be in schools, kids are being bullied, it can be, God forbid, sexual abuse. I mean, we're reading it in all communities that kids are being abused on some levels, you know. So those are the things that happen in the environment that lay fertile ground for something to develop. Now, let me also say that most people who are abused don't develop a psychiatric disorder. I mean, we often don't think about that. So it doesn't mean that if someone's sexually abused, they're going to develop a disorder. But here with borderline personality disorder, you have this genetic piece and you have this environmental piece. The environment can also not meet the needs just in general of the child, that maybe the mother is sick, maybe the mother had to go away. So all these things contribute. Any questions on that or challenges? Yeah. That's a very good question. I don't think anybody's ever studied that. I mean, when do we define someone out of childhood, right? Yeah. I don't know. I'll have to ask. A colleague of mine, Dr. Alan Fazzetti, knows the literature well. When I find out, I'll post it. Yes.